between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're excited to speak with Connie Green, founder of Wine Forest Foods and author of The Wild Table. Since 1979, Connie has been providing chefs like Thomas Keller, Corey Lee, Michael Mina, Tracy Desjardins, and many more with mushrooms of unparalleled quality. As one of the very first pioneers in the American wild mushroom business, Connie has filled a key role in educating chefs and the public about the wild foods that are now so widely loved in American cuisine. Over the decades, she's cultivated a network of amazing mushroom pickers woven across the Western U.S., Canada, Alaska, Mexico, and even Europe. Hand in hand with this wild life full of wild mushrooms is a love and respect for the forest ecosystem from which the mushrooms flow. Connie has always preached principles of sustainability and harvesting, and hopes that, in her own words, commercial mushroom hunting can give a living back to loggers and make our forests economically more valuable in the long term, left standing than converted to board feet of lumber. What a privilege to speak with a wild mushroom culture creator and pioneer in wild foraging. Connie, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
No, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, likewise, the pleasure is all mine. Huge fan of your book. And obviously, I live in Northern California, so we see wine forest mushrooms in all of our grocery stores and all over the place. So lovely to be able to speak with the maven behind the mushrooms. To kick things off, because I think it is a fascinating story, and you were really someone that pioneered wild mushroom foraging in a lot of ways, especially when you think about commercial mushroom foraging. Tell us a little bit about how that came about, you know, that sequence of events that led you to that relationship with fungi and to where you really started going out and wild harvesting and making it a business.
You know, I grew up as I'm sort of a old, tall, looks like a giant Irish woman. So I come from the Scots-Irish English tradition of mushrooms are scary. However, I'm seventh generation Florida too, and my family are early settlers, farmers, and so on. So it's typical, not just of my family, but of many families. It's not as exotic. This isn't a new thing. Mushrooms are, but the fact of gathering wild things on the perimeters of farms has been a part of American and life all over the world forever. So and my grandma and grandpa's, you know, going out and picking muscadine grapes and blackberries and digging sassafras and this sort of thing has been a part of an American tradition for a very long time. And then, you know, I moved out west back in the middle 70s, and my husband was a Estonian refugee. So the jump into mushrooms took place with falling in love and marrying a man from a foreign world whose experience was wildly different than the privilege that I grew up in, where he had to walk across Europe with his mommy and to avoid starvation in coming from a culture in which mushrooms were a treasured part of family life, like the Germans and the Poles and so on. So, but not only did he come from a cultural ethos of adoring and mushroom hunting being part of life, in their case, and in the case of many refugees, mushrooms actually kept them alive. So as they walked across Europe, mushroom hunting and finding mushrooms was literally the difference between life and death many times. So he came complete with that, and I learned from him the joy of finding mushrooms, because we moved out here and it was in pretty short order I started finding chanterelles.
That's the part of your book that really grabs you at the beginning. You talk about these beautiful chanterelle, what sounds like fields, obviously forests full of chanterelle mushrooms. And then, you know, as someone who, yeah, is imparted with really, it sounds like a reverence for mushroom hunting. I mean, a much deeper relationship than just a hobby or something you do for fun. I mean, we're talking about survival and also this ancient tradition of hunter-gatherers that has been going on since time immemorial. But how did that all translate into selling these mushrooms to, I mean, Thomas Keller is the huge name, French Laundry, but to start getting into that commercial environment, what was that transition like? Was it just you had these fields of chanterelles, started knocking on doors, or how did that come together?
That was tricky because I was finding more chanterelles than I could possibly ever consume. And it was at a time in which extra money would have been a wonderful thing. And at that time, it was far before, you know, the Nancy Oaks, the Thomas Kellers, it was before all of them appeared. Mm. So I was taking chanterelles at that point. The majority of chefs I ever met, the early ones, the Patty Underman at Hay Street, some of the American Jeremiah Tower, these kind, even though Jeremiah would have seen them certainly in Europe because he spent a lot of time there. But by and large, American chefs had never even seen one before. And so I realized that I needed to go to Europeans. And I was lucky to find a number of French chefs. Our oak chanterelles here in the Bay Area are gigantic. So they were freaked out by that. But I mean, my favorite thing was how grim it was when I went into a French chef at what was one of the two most famous restaurants in San Francisco. And the French chef said, no, 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 those aren't chanterelles. They don't grow in America. And pulled out a can, opened the can, and showed me little Girolle, little chanterelles from Europe. These are chanterelles. And I was sort of dumbstruck. And at that point, I started educating some of the American chefs and bit by bit, because I was really the first one selling them around. And it made me, you know, I have an academic background, but what made me happy was crawling around in the woods, finding chanterelles and taking them into chefs and making them happy. And it was a biofeedback loop of happiness. And it just kept rolling from there. And then for years, many years, at least 5 years, all I did was pick all winter during a rainy season. And I picked all the mushrooms and I took them all into the restaurants. And I was very lucky to be very, very good at it and have incredible hunting grounds. My single day record was still, it makes me exhausted to think of. I picked 265 pounds of chanterelles in one day.
What? That's ridiculous.
And that was my record. And but doing this, and then it'd take you 2 days to clean them, and then so on. And so I kept quite a few restaurants busy for quite a while, you know, year after year.
That is absolute insanity. I don't think I've picked 260 pounds of mushrooms in my life.
I was younger and very strong.
I guess, was it just, you know, your husband's background and he taught you about mushroom hunting, or how did you develop those forage skills?
No, I pretty much locked and fell right into it in a self-educated way. My little secret, probably head start, was that I grew up on a lake that was an ice age spring, and it was littered with fossils. So as a little child, from little child on, I was out fossil hunting. Mm. And there are some of those skills that actually cross over when you have developed an eye for spotting irregularities. Now, chanterelles are pretty noticeable, but the little lumps of the ground and this and that, the sort of skill set that you actually learn, you know, you develop your peripheral vision, you get deeply sensitive about habitat. And then it can be rinse and repeat, because you know your territory, you go back, you are essentially in some ways where it can sound terribly romantic to people, and in fact it is, but there's an element of almost farming-like if you do it right. Haunting your patches, resting them, letting grow back take place, and so on.
That is the kind of landscape management that I think is, yes, an incredibly romantic notion that so many of us dream about, is to be able to harness or work with a forest ecosystem to cultivate healthy mushrooms year in, year out. And that's definitely something I want to talk about, is that sustainability angle. We take it for granted now that all of this information is out there. I mean, if you want to learn how to go mushroom hunting, if you want to learn about habitat, especially in the Bay Area, there's so many resources, mycology clubs, much less, I mean, the internet, the totality of human knowledge kind of at our fingertips. Back then, though, was there any of that information sort of out there, or was this purely for you? I mean, mostly an autodidact path of your own relationship with the forest and understanding habitat, or were there different mycology communities or foraging communities you were networked with or involved in back when you started?
Yes, but they were not terribly helpful because, frankly, I already knew more than they did. And I'm not saying that to be vain, but it was a matter of the miles and the hours in the absorption of knowledge and practice and seeing. But I was a member, I joined the Mycological Society of San Francisco back in, I think I joined in 82 or 83, a long time ago. But because I was really quite a specialist in one species, would see other species, but you know, there are areas in America where there's a dominance of one species because of the forest type. Right. I won't tell you who, but I remember being at a table with one very famous mycologist. And he was telling the person next to them about chanterelles growing with bay trees. And I was so shocked, I opened my big mouth and said to this lord of the mushroom world, but they don't grow with bay trees. And he looked at me as this sort of snotty upstart, and he said, oh, yes, they do. Well, they don't, you know, they don't grow with bay trees. But he'd never put in the miles to know this. He was an academic. This is valuable, but in some cases, some of the knowledge or information out there, it's best to gain it on your own. Use all the guidance you can in this regard, but you will find, especially if you just put the miles in the forest and have keen powers of observation, some of these assumptions may not prove all that valuable.
Well, and where do these insights come from about ecology? At some point, someone had to observe these things in the wild, so putting in that work is your way to kind of learn these things for yourself and, you know, verify maybe some of this armchair knowledge is putting in that work. And I guess that's what I'm hearing and what you're saying is developing. I was thinking there might be some secret, and I guess searching for fossils as a kid is kind of a great foundation to have if you want to be good at mushroom foraging, but there is no great secret. It's putting the work in.
Yes, it is. You know, there's a few other things that are a bit odd that, having gone through this through time, that when I started quite early on, I really was solo, just on my own. But at one point, a restaurant, that this was after a few years of doing this, that a restaurant had had some folks show up that had driven down from Oregon with chanterelles, and they were going from restaurant to restaurant, and the restaurant had told them about me bringing in large amounts of chanterelles. Well, that clearly got the attention of these Oregonians that were driving chanterelles down here to the Bay Area. And I went in about a week later, and these people had left word. They wanted to know how I did this, because it turns out that these guys, after knowing that I had brought in lots of chanterelles, turned the world upside down here, looking for chanterelles and looking for chanterelles. But they were looking under Douglas fir trees. So they were looking in the habitat they knew from Oregon. So they were looking for the duplication of the habitat they were familiar with. And they struck out and struck out and struck out and had never managed to keep their brains open enough to know that there might be something wrong with their template of what they were looking for. But, you know, you could search for the habitat that you're used to in Oregon will not work here in the Bay Area. And it's fascinating about these presumptions that people make. This is sort of going back to that idea of being careful about whatever template of knowledge you're trying to use. This is a case with many things. I know that, for instance, matsutakes, people think, you know, matsutakes would grow under pine trees.
Right.
Pines, it's their common name, certainly in Canada, is pines. And you go up into the area in the general vicinity of Crater Lake, and indeed, this is one of the world's great matsutake areas, and they grow with pines. You come down here, you won't find them with pines. You'll find them with tan oak trees. But it took some time before people staggered into the habitats changed. It can be the same species. It can look the same. But that mushroom has been able to adapt and thrive in a different ecosystem. So some of these assumptions are tricky, and you have to be very habitat specific. And this can cause, you know, wonderful surprises.
Well, and it speaks to that importance of being open and observing an ecosystem. You know, if you're in a new area or a region where you haven't foraged before, to be open and really take those first couple rounds and, you know, whether you call that scouting or, you know, but just observing that ecology and observing habitat and taking that time. I know there are certain foragers that might spend, you know, if they're in a new area, they've just moved to an area, they might spend a season or a good part of a season just learning the lay of the land before they start doing, you know, the classic kind of crown spotting or using maps to figure out where to go. For you, I mean, did you have strategies like that, scouting, observing? Tell us a little bit about that process for you when you would try to scout new habitat.
Some of that is accident.
Right.
You know, there's, I'll give this away, but I was out with some friends in an area of the Northern California coast that is hit hard. I mean, it's clearly known and flooded with people hunting porcini, hunting bullies, Grand Edulis. I mean, it's flooded with them. But in the course of going into an area, and eventually there's no secret spots hardly over there anymore, but I happened to be taking a different path, and I found a lot of bullies, but they weren't under a pine tree. They were under a madrone tree. And so here was a completely rich, isolated madrone tree. These bullies were growing with the madrone tree. And after that, I contented myself with ignoring where the herds were and looking for isolated madrone trees. That was an accident.
That is what we define as a happy accident. And I have to ask then this myth that I keep hearing around Sonoma, Mendocino, that there are boletes that grow with oak. Have you seen this in your vast exploration? Okay, there are boletes that seem to associate with oak.
Yeah, I've forgotten a new species name, but these are what we would call, the common name is queen boletes. Those grow with oak trees. And they, look like boletes. They have darker caps. It looks like somebody sprinkled a little tiny dusting of baby powder on them. But those grow with oaks, and it's certainly no secret to the old Italians, because in the area of Sonoma and oak woods and so on, even near where I live, they're not that common. But that particular species of boletes will grow with oaks.
You certainly demystified it for me, but yeah, it seems to be in mushroom hunting circles, people know that, and I've asked some different academics and things, just different people, and they say, I've never heard of that, I wouldn't be so sure. But there you go, that's the power of putting...
It's a different species, it has a different preference, and they'll go well inland too. They have a much shorter shelf life. Hmm. Some people find them more delicious if you do a blind tasting. There's some people whose taste buds prefer that flavor, and certainly the Italians do. The old Italians did. But they have a shorter shelf life, but they're just as meaty. And when they're underground, before they emerge, the buttons look almost like your coastal Boletus Grand Edulis. They can be looking like a little bread colored. And then when they emerge from the leaf litter, the cap starts turning dark, and they're beautiful.
That's one of those mushrooms that I think I found before and just called it Boletus Edulis. But yeah, really interesting to hear about that experiential knowledge of where these things grow and keeping our minds open to, you know, putting in the miles being an amazing way to learn. You know, it's great to have book knowledge. It's great to learn all that stuff out of guides, but no substitute for that real experience out in the woods. And then I don't want to give away too many secrets, but we've mentioned chanterelles a lot. That was kind of your first big mushroom love, and 260 pounds.
It
still is, of course. And one of my favorite mushrooms, definitely. There's nothing like finding that gold out in the forest. So what is that habitat here in Northern California? What are tips for people listening to go out and have success finding chanterelles?
We have the chanterelles grow here. I help provide the specimens for the DNA work. They're identified as a different species. Those are Cantharellus californicus. So this is a mushroom that grows only here in an area. They've been found, as far as I know, the northern edge is going to be up around Redway, southern Humboldt County, and it goes, you know, well down and past Big Sur. But these are the largest chanterelles in the world. They're undisputedly the giants, which freaks out a French chef who wants one with a diameter of about an inch. But they grow primarily with coastal and interior live oaks. Their favorite companion tree is coastal and interior live oaks. The profile that they prefer is under the drip line of a more mature tree and at the edge of a meadow. So I can drive around and see, you know, if you were able to look out my window right now, you would see the classic. It's on the covers of the old phone books. It's on, you know, any kind of postcard of the interior oak forest. You'll see gold, you know, meadows, a little bit greener gold, and sort of ringed in patches around that will be these live oaks spreading around the edges of these beautiful meadows. That's what they like, is the edge of those meadows, the interface of meadow and frequently a more mature tree. Although, you know, oaks are funny. I can find a great many chanterelles around young live oak trees, but you don't see as many of them. Oaks live for such a long time that when younger ones do come because of their active root growth, you can find a lot. But they will generally be filling in some, you know, a void by a fallen giant oak tree, and it's growing up. And I'm old enough and I've been in these woods long enough that I've actually seen the sequence of trees that were very young and then now are 7 inches in diameter and have their own chanterelles. And whether it be by root grafts, spreading spores, or whatever, you know, they will go in succession, but that's the habitat they really love. And particularly deep leaf litter, not grass growing under the tree, but the deep, luxurious leaf litter under those older oaks.
That's funny you say that. I still remember when I first learned about chanterelles and that association with oaks, we went out to those really kind of classic Sonoma big grass fields with solitary oaks out in the grass, thinking, oh, this will be perfect. And you run out there and there's never any chanterelles. Yes. And it needs that nice leaf duff. And as you elucidated that as well, I'm thinking some of my best chanterelle spots, you know, some actually are small oaks, but they are usually on the border of a meadow. So that makes a lot of sense. I didn't put together that pattern, but I think you just helped put that together for me.
Well, in the drip line, they love the drip line. And they love that they don't like cattle, you know, and they sure as hell don't like where pigs have been. Pigs have the unfortunate thing of rooting through that luxuriant leaf litter, wild pigs, which shouldn't be here, rooting through that luxuriant leaf litter, rooting and just rototilling it, looking for eating little newts. And they're not eating the chanterelles, but they're destroying that beautiful skin under the leaf litter that's decaying and so on.
It's fascinating. And of course, this love affair with chanterelles has since expanded out to every gourmet wild edible mushroom we can imagine. So when did this for you get codified into wine forest? Like I said, you see it in grocery stores around here. If you go to any mycological show in the Bay Area, you will see the beautiful wine forest table full of wild mushrooms. But was this just kind of an organic thing as you kept hunting? It just snowballed. You know, how did Wine Forest start? What was the ethos? And then did it change your foraging practice at all?
Well, because I can only pick chanterelles during the rainy season here, so that limited me to 4 to 5 months of the year. You know, it's very hard for me to piece back how it began, but I was, rather than being disturbed, I was elated to find there were other people like me. They were just in different places. And so I ended up getting connected with some morel pickers. At this point, chanterelles had gotten underway in the Pacific Northwest as a harvestable crop. And for a period of time, Germans came in and had people, you know, sort of made it known that they would buy chanterelles. People learned how to do that. And of course, they're abundant in Washington. This is in Washington State. I guess the big breakthrough for me was being steered into a strange little town, which was a complete astonishment to me. This is long over, but many, like 30 plus years ago, a little town called Ukiah, Oregon, not California, but Oregon, a town way in sort of central, very, very remote town of 200 people. But a phenomena happened there, which was, this was an area of a great, huge white fir forest. The white fir trees were beginning their deterioration from a disease. Because of that, morels were existing there as we call them naturals, but it was exacerbated by the decaying, the death, the slow death of these white fir forest. So this became Morel Central. And that became one of the most important places for morels in the entire world. People started the sort of, it's a odd conglomeration of odd ducks that will follow and find and like dogs sniffing out. And for a period of years, there would be 2,000 pickers in Ukiah, Oregon. And on a given night, I remember being there one night, 40,000 pounds of morels were brought in a single day. And a drying morels, and in the Blue Mountains all around there. So for 20 years, this was one of the most important places for morels in the world. You know, like Turkey is a big place for morels and so on, but this was extraordinary. And then lightning fires struck, and that would end up creating even more morels in the areas where it burned. Insane. So this became an extraordinary place for morels. And this is where one of the early places where I saw my first gray morel, and it was people like David Aurora had, I think he'd only seen them for the first time there as well. There were a few people like him that were absolutely, you know, thrilled to pieces by things that academics didn't really even know existed. And to this, you know, at that point, mycologists weren't interested in that. What they could have learned from hanging around with those guys for a few months would have, it would take your breath away.
What happened to that area?
The trees, this is a sort of thing that, it's a tragedy. And this is something that can be interpreted foolishly by people. But eventually the disease swept. It took over 20 years for the white firs to finally die. And with the death of the white firs, the atrophying of their roots, the things that morels love, which is decaying matter, and the mystery of some morels being partially mycorrhizal, possibly, there's still the issue about that mystery. And eventually the trees died. And so the morel scene there ended. It lasted a gloriously long time. But this issue of succession and the changing of habitat, it's interesting to see that because we are certainly in the midst of it now. You live long enough, you'll see the succession, the success of, or the failure of a forest system. And our biggest example of that is, of course, fire.
Yeah, and talk about that a little bit, because that was something you mentioned before the show, how you've watched habitats evolving in California. I mean, what I think you just hit on a huge one there, maybe the biggest, but what are the dynamics that you're seeing as changing habitats for wild mushrooms in California? And is there hope that we will have continued abundance of mushrooms? Are things on a downward trajectory? What are your thoughts around that?
I wish I knew, but you can see things that, you know, this is very Bay Area or Northern California oriented, which is right. A bit unfair. But that is what I know something about. But it isn't just the sequence of fires is a normal thing in the world, not to the degree that we have them now, most assuredly. But for instance, sudden oak death. When sudden oak death came about as an invading disease that has had a terrible impact on some of the trees that host chanterelles, for instance, where live oak trees are highly subject to it, but more tragically, so are tan oak trees, even more so. So the destruction of tan oak trees is a tragedy that really bothers me. Not only the invasion of sudden oak death, but in addition to that, there's a horrific amount of logging of tan oak trees in the vicinity of Northern California from, you know, the Fort Bragg area, north and south of there, where there's a great deal of land that's owned by lumber companies. And tan oak trees host a huge number of mushrooms. Tan oak trees host black trumpets, Matsutake. These are the two species that have a torrid affair with tan oak trees. These are the mothership of those two species in our area up there. And along with that will come, you know, the odd hedgehog and yellowfeet and this sort of thing. And frankly, even some of the dark bullets you were talking about, the dark cat porcini, there's been a campaign, it's quite heartbreaking, where, you know, this is one of the places that I buy mushrooms and where a lot of the pickers that I know for 30 something years is the black trumpet season, which is in the wintertime here, to go be gone for a year and come back and then find a very rich tan oak forest that the really horrible thing is you'll see them and they'll have been hit by an axe. So a huge portion of the bark has been chipped off and then sprayed blue on that wound. And that spray is a systemic poison to kill the trees. So they'll actively kill those trees. It's easier to, you know, for whatever reason, it appears to be easier to kill them first before, because that wood is not valuable to the lumber companies that are better off in their long-term plan of replacing it with Douglas fir, for instance, that's a more high-value crop. And so we've lost huge amounts of tan oak trees to by the lumber industry. And now I don't have a grudge against the lumber industry per se,
right.
But you know, the whole habitats have been destroyed over there because of this idea of getting rid of a quote junk unquote tree to replace it with more profitable use of that land that they own. But unfortunately, we've lost tremendous amounts of incredible black trumpet habitat to that.
It seems like an incredibly ham-fisted way to manage forests. I understand there's an economic incentive, but this doesn't seem intelligent even for them in the long run. But you know, this is something that I found as an undercurrent really in the ethos behind what you do as well, is this idea that by promoting and educating and sharing this bounty of wild food, we can change, even just through a strictly economic incentive, we can change that perspective around forests, as like you so beautifully I quoted from you in the intro, as more than just their board feet of lumber. You know, the forests are an active, thriving system that if left undisturbed, will yield hugely economically and culinarily valuable products, if you want to call it that, but beautiful mushrooms. Talk about that dynamic a little bit, if you think that's changing, and then, you know, talk about how that dynamic might play out in the future.
This is really tough because where in theory this is the case, in practice, it's actually reality. A study done by the University of Oregon, as I recall, the value, let's just say the area around Chemult in Oregon, where it's pine trees, this is a huge matsutake harvest area. The value of the matsutake that are harvested in the forest there is vastly greater than the timber harvest value. But the issue of the value of standing forests in terms of their economic value for mushroom harvesting, it's a sound concept. It's certainly sound in the case of matsutakes. The trick is that there's multiple issues in translating this into reasonable policy. And it's a multifaceted thing, one of which is a lot of the forests are owned by and large by a lot of timber companies, for one, and right. Timber is what they know. This is what they know. They're not in the mushroom business. They're in the lumber business. This has given me some sympathy for the logging companies. And in fact, many of them have been, not necessarily welcoming, but have had no objections in many cases to mushroom pickers going in their land and picking mushrooms. And in some case, some of the lumber companies, will sell them a permit or get permission and so on, and can be agreeable to that because oddly enough, they have some knowledge of the wild and forest systems. I mean, that is what they do. Even their goal at the end is different than my own. The other territory that is more problematic, I think, is the National Forest Service. The National Forest Service is owned by all of us. We are taxpayers. We own these public lands.
Right.
But in fact, the National Forest Service is a sort of a long-standing relationship there. I think it's pretty evident if you go into almost any National Forest Service, and they'll often have a little store, or if you're going to go camping, you can go in and get a permit for a fire permit or a camping permit or something. But if you look behind the counter, you look at the office, you're going to see these giant binders. The giant binders are generally going to say fruit growers, Georgia Pacific, and so on. Their relationship with timber harvesting is a very intimate one. And in fact, the creation of the National Forest and the preservation of a lot of our forest lands long ago had some basic idea of this being the reservoir of wood, of timber for the building of America, This would be one of the resources that logger companies could use. Unfortunately, that relationship is so intimate that it kind of precludes the logic of going, if you sold I'm going to back up for a minute.
Yeah.
Each of our National Forest Service districts, to make it even more confusing, each of them is a bit of a feudal empire where each one has its own policies, its own rules, its own decisions they make about the use of special forest products, logging, and so on. So the very place I told you about, for instance, Ukiah, Oregon, with the Morels, they learned through time. Initially, it was a terrible shock to them to have this onslaught of mushroom pickers there. But in very short order, it really just took 1 or 2 years before they were very, very helpful, very agreeable. They realized they sold permits. The town got over their shock when they started seeing and realizing that that restaurant, they couldn't serve enough food. The little convenience store couldn't sell enough beer and carrots and so on. And the benefit to the community was incredible. And then the teenagers and people, the residents of town are out picking mushrooms. And it became a period of time in which everybody was thriving. And during the duration of that time, it in no way had any impact on the environment. They're harvesting a completely, Morel's behavior is notably different than mycorrhizal mushrooms. But it was a win-win situation. It's no harm to the habitat. There were points in which I think they had merit. They were concerned about a certain period of time in which elk were calving, with whether mushroom hunters in the wood would disturb elk calving. But by and large, this ended up being kind of a non-issue. There was wilderness territory that was off limits, understandable. They sold permits. They came, that forest district was an enlightened one, and they missed the mushroom hunters to this day. You know, the people in Ukiah would love to have everybody back.
Yeah.
And yet other forest districts will go to elaborate trouble. I mean, including hiring helicopters to prevent people from mushroom picking. I can go on and on.
But. Well, that was the story you were telling me, and that sounds like classic government bureaucracy of kind of feudal empires divvying things up and not having consistent policies. I'm not surprised. But yeah, you were talking about how for burn morels, they've been blocking people from going to burn areas. Talk about that a little bit.
I just talked to, actually, right before we started this, I talked to one of the commercial guys I know very well. And a notable one was, I mean, we know this from this behavior and this capricious decision-making that goes on with the National Forest Service. But one was particularly notable because it overlapped with a mycological society. The largest mycological society in America is the Mycological Society of San Francisco. And it's very large. And one of the territories that people in that society go to frequently is the area toward north of Yosemite. It's National Forest Service. It's a very large area. And it's not part of the Yosemite Park whatsoever. But there was a fire there. And that fire, they made the decision to close down all access to that fire. And they went to the trouble of closing all the roads. They got sawhorses and caution tape and put sawhorses on every conceivable car pullover. And it was like no mushroom picking, no parking. They went to huge expense to patrol it all and close it all down so no one could pick on this incredibly rich morel fruiting going on there.
What a waste.
There were colossal fines for going there. Well, in this case, they've done this sort of thing, but they hadn't done it in the face of the Mycological Society of San Francisco, which is occupied by doctors, lawyers, professional people that are more palatable to the powers that be in the National Forest Service than the stray rough and tough commercial mushroom hunters. They hit real resistance with the Mycological Society, who fought back valiantly. And by the time that fight was over and the head of that forest district had been assaulted by resistance in terms of, what the hell are you thinking? Why is this? This makes no sense. Their reasons kept changing for why they were closing that down. The primary thing is that it was closed for, this is a frequent story, for salvage logging, so that salvage loggers could be in there harvesting the trees, but American taxpayers could not come in there and pick mushrooms.
Right.
It was too dangerous. Then they had thought for a while they would let people go in and pick if they would wear helmets. And then they just got more and more and more ridiculous. And they finally kind of knuckled under how it could be okay. And by that time, the season was over. Mm. But this is sort of repeated in many, many places. And their rationale at one point, I remember one fire that was closed down and there's been many here in the Bay Area. And there's going to be many more. But one of which was my friend Joe is talking to the National Forest Service guy, and he's saying, no, nobody gets to mushroom hunt on this fire because of erosion. You guys will cause erosion. Meantime, he's staring at two caterpillars going up the hills, you know, dragging logs off.
Talk about disturbance and erosion. Yeah.
Yes. And this sort of thing. But this is something that is phenomenally irritating. There is so many, particularly with the tragedy of all these fires, it's a one-time shot. You know, the spring after the fires is when you pick morels. And people of all stripes now, as foraging and mushroom hunting has been more popular, people could fill their larders, dry morels, have the best time choosing us over salvage logging, which is going to yield little to nothing and could be done in the summertime when it isn't morel season. It's something that needs to be addressed, best of all by mycological societies, I believe.
And that was actually a beautiful example of the mycological societies and commercial foragers having common cause. I think often there's kind of a false dichotomy that gets put into play there, where these two groups can often be seemingly put at odds over, you know, oh, the commercial foragers took all the mushrooms and the amateur mycological societies kind of, but I'm glad they were able to come together to push this forward. And I understand that, you know, as public institutions, the Forest Service may have, you know, I don't want to apologize for them or assume anything about them, but they may have a tough spot there to manage these different interests. But you got to believe these two things aren't mutually exclusive. To get the bounty of morels and do salvage logging, come on, guys, we're creative. I know there's a way that we can do both. And for many Californians, I mean, if we have to suffer through the fires, the least we can have then is the morels that come afterwards, that if you don't pick them, would just, I mean, they would go to insects and other wildlife.
Yes.
But, you know, there would be kind of a waste there for humans that have borne the brunt of the fire. And, you know, we'll kind of wrap up the arc of wine forests because you want to talk about, but the last big issue then affecting commercial foragers, we've talked about changing habitat. We've talked about the interplay with government and different institutions on forage grounds, but we've been talking around this idea of sustainability as well. And that's something that I know is kind of at the center of your practice. And we talked about that idea of you're almost farming the mushrooms. You know, for you, how does sustainability play into foraging? And do you see that commercial foraging is something that can sustain and expand into the future, despite some of these challenges with habitat and different things we've been talking about?
Well, it's important to know the science about particularly mycorrhizal, the harvesting of mycorrhizal mushrooms. Sadly, you know, there's people that, you know, a little knowledge can be
dangerous thing.
Dangerous. And the idea that going and picking all the hedgehogs around a bunch of huckleberry brush in an area is going to mean that there will be no more hedgehog mushrooms. This is clearly, it's important for people to understand that this is no more relevant than somebody coming onto my property and telling me that I have to leave half the apples on the tree or there won't be any more apples. Okay. That it is just that foolish. There is a natural thing. One could make the argument that this dispersal of spores is important. Commercial mushroom hunters, for one, and frankly, most hobbyists, use baskets, for heaven's sakes. We're sprinkling spores. We're dispersing spores as human vectors like mad. So in my case, we have certain rules that we're really, you know, I've been at this for a while. I've been part of, and I have tons of friends, and I'm part of three mycological societies, that there's behavior that we work hard at, and that, frankly, mycological society members don't, because they don't really have the chops or the miles in about this. For instance, if you are picking, like, I would never dream of picking or selling or anything. Black trumpets, for instance, that the cup of the black trumpet wasn't at least the size of a quarter on the top. Right. All right. You would never think of picking a morel that was the size of your pinky finger. It should be the size of your thumb and so on and so forth. The idea of leaving the baby mushrooms to grow does multiple things. It, in a very Machiavellian way, it creates more weight. There's more mushroom there when you let it grow a little more. There just is. And also at the same time, the mushroom is matured to the point that it's starting to produce spores and dispersing spores. And there's more for everybody when you behave in that way. I have to be careful when I'm with mushroom pickers are forever looking at each other's baskets and questioning when they don't know each other and running into the woods. Let me see what you got. And it's like, nod your head. Okay, you didn't pick babies. But sadly, the Mycological Society people will pick everything and pick things that and discard them and throw them into the
leaf litter. Not even eat them.
So that tragically, you know, when a foray has gone on and 20 people have gone through the woods, it looks like a herd of buffalo have been there. You know, when we as commercial hunters go through the woods, you will never know we'd even been there. And in a weird way, I mean, that is just a tiny part of the sustainable nature of it. And also your footpaths. I'm a real Nazi about this in my own behavior, but I don't have to be with the people that are professional mushroom pickers like me. We're very careful about our footfalls. We're careful about how we walk. We're careful about the paths we take. In my chanterelle habitat, I have, you know, you will see in the woods, you'll see deer trails. You know, you will see a rut, which deer have followed in a certain way. That's what it looks like when we hunt. And because there's a sort of care, soil compaction is a big issue for me, where you, if you've stomped around all over the place, you've compacted the soil. And what you, if you're only in it for the moment, you may not care. But if you're in it for the longer haul, where you know you're going to come back a week later, a week after that, a week after that, all those places where you've stomped around like a buffalo, you've already smashed babies that are underground that aren't going to come up now. So we're very careful about leaving things as uncompacted as possible. And this goes for scouting too. You will go check patches over and over again that they're not ready. Why stomp all over it, for God's sakes? You should be able to see. You should be in a low position under a tree or on a hillside where you can look up and see.
Well, it's a new perspective that makes so much sense. These are people who have so much invested. When you talk about commercial foragers, these are people who have so much invested in these patches, more than just, you know, a patch that they're there during a hike and they might never be back. I mean, this is kind of their crop, their food source. So they're going to be very mindful about sustainability. Do you think this is something that is widespread in commercial foragers? That's kind of what I'm taking from what you're saying, because there's this image out there, this boogeyman of the commercial forager who does the opposite, stomps in, lifts up all the leaf litter, slices down all the surrounding low-lying bushes and grass, and is just mercenary about picking through the mushrooms and damaging ecology. Can we throw that out the window and know that commercial foragers...
Throw it out the window, but there's some explanations for that, because I've traveled in both worlds. I was in the Mycological Society for years, and I had to keep, I kept my mouth shut as they would trash commercial pickers. And the boogeyman of commercial pickers is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard, because for multiple reasons. One, the sustainability of mushroom harvest to a commercial picker is more important than to anyone, because if you don't find the mushrooms and if you don't take care of the beds where they come from, you need to go back there year after year after year. You can't scout forever and keep coming. These are repeat visits to the same habitat year after year. These have to be carefully treated, because if you don't, you have no gas and you have no food. When commercial mushroom hunters go out, the proof positive about doing a good job is you get to eat and you get to drive and you get to do this year after year after year. Unfortunately, I have found more often that, tragically, is that overzealous amateur mushroom hunters can do more damage than commercial mushroom hunters. And there is a trial and error thing. I know personally, I can confess to making a terrible mistake many, many years ago. I learned from it and I will never do it again. There was an oak tree. It was probably 300 or 400 years old. I went through, I was at the bottom of that tree. I looked up, there were chanterelles everywhere. I went from the bottom to the top, moving a leaf litter and putting it back. Moving, I picked, I think, 40 pounds from that one tree. And, but because I was so thorough And because I moved the leaf litter, the next year that tree had one quarter of what it had. I made a terrible mistake. I violated that tree's, the leaf litter, the skin underneath it that protects the tree. And, you know, unfortunately, people are continuing to learn that lesson by being brutal. Raking, this sort of thing. One of the things that also gets mistaken for brutal treating is truffle hunters. Truffle hunters rake. And this is something that we don't really have in California, but you do in Oregon. When you see this, it's horrifying. And the truffle hunters, a lot of them are actually not commercial people at all. They're out people out looking for truffles. There's educational films and so on with Matsutake that raking does not take place. There's a lot of mythos about this that just simply is not true. And when I sort of outed myself as a commercial mushroom hunter to the Mycological Society, I wrote an article for the newsletter. And the result of that is after that and every foray, everybody wanted to go out with me, you know. I guess it's so obvious to me, it's harder to describe. Part of this is racist and class structure stuff. People are wary. Many of the commercial mushroom hunters are Lao, Cambodian, Mexican, Vietnam vets, retired loggers or loggers that left the industry. There's even some fishermen. These are people that are rough and tough, and they don't look like a surgeon in his off hours with his Volvo, you know? And tragically, that makes them the other. And we are, as you know, people really have to evaluate their own class structure perspective before they come to those conclusions, because it's very much present.
Absolutely. That's something I've actually had UK or foragers over in England brought that up to me as well when we started talking about commercial foraging. And it becomes this kind of drumbeat to talk about Eastern Europeans that they don't want to come raiding their forests. So that's a really interesting dichotomy. And especially for those of us who kind of join this growing, swelling mycology and mycophile community, we like to think that we kind of put all those differences to the side, classism, considerations of race, none of that matters. We all love these mushrooms. And I think for a large part that does happen, but it's good to be aware of that, where those kind of divisions creep up, even in something that may seem more innocuous, like, oh, commercial foragers, you know, that whole specter gets raised. And we may need to look for the roots of some of these other divisions and make sure we're not bringing that to the party.
Well, there's an interesting thing that, because here we are in the States, if you cross the border into Canada, it's completely different. They don't have those attitudes. They don't feel that way. Commercial mushroom hunters and go all over BC or Saskatchewan or wherever, or even in Alaska, you can go all over there. They think it's the greatest. You're here to pick mushrooms? Wow, how you do that? And they want, you know, this is welcomed and revered as a thing of people going into the wild and being successful. They love it. It's respected. So there are cultural differences that make it nakedly clear that there's other things at work here.
Well, hopefully that's starting to change. Hopefully people, you know, as mycology becomes more mainstream, hopefully that'll change. But yeah, maybe there's some more of that divisiveness embedded. Canadians are definitely nicer, I think. But maybe
there's another thing too, that when you were asking about some of the ethos that I try to operate with, there's actually a very practical thing that even here where I am, I hunt on private land in my immediate area here. So I'm not ever on any public land. But within the Bay Area, the circuit pickers, the commercial mushroom pickers that are part of my world, they're not down here. They don't come here. Why on earth would they? There's too many people here. So that the real mushroom pickers, it's a waste of time and effort. You don't want to be where there's a lot of people. You don't want to be where there's a lot of it's counterproductive. You do not want to do that. What happens is that I will hunt on private ground, but beyond that, I don't buy any mushrooms from anybody within a zone of about, if you use San Francisco as the center, and you went out, I would go 75 to 100 miles outside of that radius before I will ever buy mushrooms from. It's always, it has to be outside that area for a lot of reasons, some of which are absolutely practical. There is too much traffic and too many people hunting down here. It isn't worth your time. It isn't worth the trouble. It isn't a good investment of miles and footfalls and so on. So when you see, you know, what you were describing, these are going to be, frankly, enthusiasts and maybe even hipsters that are deciding that they're going to go out and become, pick mushrooms and take them into restaurants and this. And that certainly does go on. It's in a minimal way, but there's enthusiasts that do that, but they are not the actual real professional mushroom hunters at all. These are a different crowd. And I don't have anything to do with them.
That's actually an important delineation. Is, yeah, there's the amateur kind of weekend warrior with the mycological society. There's the commercial forager that literally does it full time. And then there's something in between. I think we've all had that dream as amateurs who love to get out in the woods is, oh, maybe if I have extra, I can sell it to restaurants. So there's kind of that level as well.
There's places, for instance, we have a park in another part of Napa County. I've gone there for fun with an old Italian guy to help, but I would never dream of picking there. That's their spot. The other is like in our immediate area, famous, sadly, because so many of the public and state parks forbid mushroom hunting. Salt Point is one of the only places people can pick. So this is not a place that my people go ever. And it would be foolish, but there are people that get overexcited over there and decide they're going to go pick 30 pounds of porcini and take them into a restaurant. And this is, to me, morally offensive because that's shared territory. Mm. That's shared territory that everybody, this is why I'm really not very offended by some of the limits they impose on that, because it makes it possible for more to go around when there's such limited territory that it's legal to pick in.
And so that's another aspect of sustainability, is that idea of limits and shared territory and being mindful of that. And all of these are answering the question I had here about, as you're developing wine forests, you know, Connie can't do it all. How are you navigating this ecosystem, finding pickers and sources that you can trust to then go to the restaurants that you've established connections with? And I think that you're describing that, but I mean, it sounds like a lot of this knowledge is really hard-won experience.
Yeah, and making it up as you're going along. I think that's some of the happiest things in life is there is no path. You figure it out. And in this case, there's a lot of us are getting older that were part of, you know, the sort of pioneering work and all of this. So it's evolved for me in some ways that, like, Joan is one of the great mushroom pickers. Well, Joan decided to settle down in the Olympic Peninsula about 25 years ago. So she lives there, and there's a gang of pals that see each other in the bar, or they see each other wherever, and then the Macaw Reservation's not far away. And there's retired loggers, and there's about 20 folks that live there all the time. And so the mushrooms come from those guys, and Joan stays put. So when the rains come, if they ever do, the mushrooms will come from them. And Joan, who has no tolerance for bad mushrooms or poorly picked or dirty mushrooms, that we just won't have that. And these guys, there's a little family up there, and they get paid more than anybody else. And they get to pick beautiful mushrooms like they're proud of. My goal is to have these kinds of symbiotic relationships in different places and symbiotic relationships with folks that I've known for years and years. And, you know, every once in a while, I mean, person that buys for me, that it's sort of our little tribe there, Raleigh will look at a bucket of mushrooms that some poor local has dragged in and go, "Do you realize people have to eat those?" And then it's through time, good people.
And I'm sure there's so many stories and amazing personalities of people you've met. But in general, how large has this network grown now? These kind of sequences of people you can trust, buying from other foragers. How big would you estimate that wine forest network is at this point?
Well, it changes because by seasons, unfortunately, as we learned this year, there's seasons, that whole seasons that fail.
Yeah.
You know, that may be going on the Oregon and Washington coast right now. This is an epic drought. It's not the first one I've seen. And so that gives me hope that, unfortunately, I think conclusions can be made about things that may not, you know, I have a longer haul view of some of this.
Yeah.
And the issue of how we'll get through this drought, I do not know. But we have gone through them before. This is particularly severe. But the size of it varies in terms of there are people, there's fewer of them, that follow what we used to sort of call the mushroom circuit. And what this would amount to is coastal chanterelles, coastal hedgehogs, a season that could go from late August, and in some cases, people all the way up into Saskatchewan, from late August, middle August, the chanterelles beginning on the coast, the matsutake season going on inland, and that rolls on, and then all the way into where we are, which not everybody comes to, thank heavens, but our winter season. California is blessed in actually the borderline of California and Oregon, the little banana belt around Brookings, where we don't have a winter per se. We have a very long autumn, so that we have mushrooms when no one else does. So this can go on and on. So it can go from boletes on the coast to matsutake and then flow right into black trumpets and flow to hedgehogs and yellowfeet. And then after that, you head up into the Sierras or up into Oregon and the morels begin. And then there's a dead period of time that becomes huckleberry season. And this is one of the only crossover things that isn't mushrooms. And then the wheel starts turning again. But there's many people that will stay, and well, especially as some of the pickers have gotten older, will settle in a certain area and work within a territory of two or three states. There's fewer people doing the whole circuit, partly because with climate change and our weather changes, keeping that wheel going as an economic strategy for survival is becoming more difficult. It's certainly very difficult this year.
Yeah, so it ends up being these people, when they do set down, you get kind of these smaller nodes of the network that then pull from those local pickers. And
yes.
And obviously we know things started with chanterelles, but how many mushrooms are you guys selling today and wild food products? Give us kind of the updated line, let's say, of wine forest mushrooms.
It's like the alphabet. I mean, it's the obvious ones: chanterelles, hedgehogs, yellowfeet, black trumpets, boletes, morels of different degrees. There's, you know, there's naturals, there's conicas, and there's the magical gray morels. There are matsutakes. There, it's almost easier for me to say the mushrooms I don't sell.
We don't carry. Yeah.
Some things that I think one of the things that I ponder, and I don't know quite what to make of it. I can be a bit of a chicken shit about certain species. There's things that I worry about, which is allergy levels for certain mushrooms. There's things like sulfur shells or, you know, chicken of the woods. I do not sell those. I will not sell verpas. And both of these are things that I try to think about. If somebody gets poisoned in a restaurant and they want to come and sue somebody and they look for me, of things in which there is a real good grounds for saying, one, you can look at almost all those other mushrooms and say, oh, well, let's see, there's 900 years of human consumption of these. But there are things I have to be a keen observer of the allergy responses to certain mushrooms by people I know and so on. So I'm just particularly on the conservative side. there's other mushrooms that would be a joy to sell, but they're so perishable or so difficult, or they're growing in some place that transport is very difficult. So to a great extent, it is some of these classic mushrooms. And, you know, a lot of the mushrooms we have on the West Coast are very much out of a European culinary tradition, usefulness, with the exception of matsutake. And lobster mushrooms. Lobster mushrooms are not appreciated in Europe at all. They don't really grow.
But they're beautiful, and I love them so much. But, you know, as this interest expands, obviously you're a business now spanning states, you're supplying restaurants, you're supplying grocery stores. What do you see the future of, maybe I could say, regulation of this industry? Because I know in some states there are these efforts now at licensing. You know, foragers have to take a test. And when you talked about this ecosystem of foragers who are a lot of times from all different backgrounds, kind of more rough and ready. And I know there are a lot of folks who basically are people of the woods that love hunting mushrooms that are like, I'm not going to get a license for this thing. I'm not going to carry insurance. What do you see that future? I mean, will things just continue as they are? Kind of industry regulates, enforces itself in terms of knowledge and standards. Do you see any shifts happening? Because we're just seeing, or at least from my perspective, we're seeing this explosion of interest in wild mushrooms, more people wanting to pick and eat them than ever. Do you think there's some more regulation on the horizon, or what does that look like?
Well, I've tried. We've tried. This has come up for 30 years in California. And each time it has, a lot of effort has been put into the idea of regulation, where the public health department will suddenly go, well, let's see here. I can give you an incident. I was suddenly in my driveway. This was 28, almost 30 years ago. A SWAT team appeared. And there was suddenly three agencies, federal government, state, and the county, that came in my driveway and had heard that I sold wild mushrooms. I called a neighbor of mine to come over because I realized I was going to be dealing with people that may have a lot of attitude and maybe not a lot of knowledge. So a friend came over who happened to be a Clinton appointee who worked in the White House. I just happened to have that up my sleeve. So they came over to sit in on this conversation. And it was fascinating because it had come to the attention of the health department that wild mushrooms were being served. Actually, it wasn't that, it might have been about 26 years ago, that wild mushrooms were being served in restaurants. They had no idea. Wild mushrooms had been served at restaurants at that point for quite some time. So they sat there and explained to me that there was no way to tell one mushroom from another, that they all looked the same. And they had that I was in endangering lives because there was no way, blah, blah, blah. This went on. So they were going to close down all mushroom sales and they were extending us to all of California. I decided at that point that, for one, I drove down to the French Laundry and went into Thomas Keller's office and said, guess what? Truffles are going to be banned in California. Truffles are a wild mushroom. All right. This was fascinating. So suddenly there was an organization of chefs and the health department wanted to be involved in this. And this was not the first time. There was a time well before that that they tried to get to. But to make a long story short, at the end of the day, we went to elaborate work. And then California decided, well, there doesn't seem to be any problem. So we won't do this after all. So regulation has never taken place in California, despite three major attempts to do so. And I'm not opposed to it. Frankly, it would do me good if, once again, a totally Machiavellian way, if you had to have a license and pass tests and so on to sell wild mushrooms, not unlike seafood, which there's some merit to if you're selling crustaceans and mussels and so on, you may want that. But it has never gone anywhere because of the lack of proof that there's been any danger. I still think it's a good idea. It's a good idea for me. But, you know, on the other hand, when, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith go out and on their property, they've got 15 pounds of porcini and they want to go into their Italian restaurant and trade dinner for them, they're not going to be able to do that. That would be a shame, because it, you know, it's no skin off my nose, but it does seem somewhat of a shame to do that. The other downside, I mean, I think there's more plus sides than negative sides, but one negative side was a very serious issue, and this is, I believe, has come up in there's a few states that are regulated, was the idea of a species list of what could be traded and a list of species that could be sold. This becomes very difficult. It really does, and very controversial. I submitted my species lists to the health department, and they were horrified because there were about 20 species on it. And these were super conservative ones. But they went, oh, no, no, no. You should only be able to sell 3 or 4 varieties. I'd like you to go through and think of who you're going to eliminate. Does that mean you can no longer sell yellow feed? You can no longer sell hedgehogs? You can no longer sell candy caps? You know, this becomes a problem. So thus far, there is no regulation, but I'm not at all sure that it wouldn't be merited in some way. There are trapdoors. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and I appreciate that really balanced perspective. And I have heard similar, and I think there is that principle as well, that once you insert government regulation or licensure, you're kind of giving the prerogative of whatever that organization is and whatever its shifting motives are as people move offices and things to change that. And suddenly, you know, basically once you have regulation or licensure inserted, it's really hard to get rid of and go back to the more freeform system. So that kind of once it's in there, you can't go back. And how do chefs feel about that? I mean, do chefs, because it would seem like they have a big onus to like, hey, I really need to know and trust for you. I need to know and trust Connie with really the lives of people I'm serving. I mean, I would guess there's also a deep educational component from your end as well for them.
Well, there is. But I'll give you an example of an argument for regulation, even though, once again, I would say it would benefit me.
Yeah.
But it isn't, I'm not necessarily in favor of it. But I'll give you an example, and it is a bit worrisome to me that we're very, very lucky that, because by and large, chefs are quite ignorant about mushroom species. They can identify chanterelles, they can identify, but there's a lot of things that, you know, a 3-year-old Polish kid can identify, no problem. You know, it's that easy. But there was a chef that was determined to serve ovally. Well, we have our mushroom in California, Amanita cuprata, common names, coccoli, coccora, and the old Italian population has eaten them for years. Unfortunately, people have died eating them because Amanita floydes was never a native species. It is an invading species that's here in droves now. So even people that have hunted coccolis for ages have, one has died. I know another who had to have a liver transplant and so on. Old Italian people eating Amanita floydes by accident. But one chef had wanted me to come and identify because he had bought ovales, which are in egg form. Now, you can't really identify them in egg form unless you peel back the skin. And he was dead determined they were ovally, just like in Italy. It was like, they sell them in Italy. So we had a very big argument, and I told him that unfortunately, if he was going to do that, I could never sell to him again. And I begged him not to serve those. But there are mistakes that can happen. We're very lucky it never has. But this is one of those issues where if it was regulated in Europe, people have to pass tests. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't have to necessarily create an elaborate bureaucracy. But you could have something maybe like a license that you're capable of identifying these clearly, and therefore you're able to sell these things clearly and pass some sort of competence thing.
I think that balance makes a lot of sense to me. The idea of licensing by species, and that keeps it open to really everyone at every level of commercial foraging. You might not have to take a test that tests your knowledge of every mushroom. If you know just your chanterelles and your porcinis, you get certified in just those species, and then it adds that trust to the supply chain and doesn't put all the onus on the chef to suddenly become a mycologist as well to make sure it's safe.
Yeah.
It's an interesting discussion that I'm sure will get teased out more in the coming years. Like, as I said, people get more and more interested in wild mushrooms and want more of them on their plates. And that was kind of one of my last overarching questions about this industry now. Do you think there are some edible species that are going to kind of enter the culinary mainstream? You know, I've heard mushrooms like tremella put forth and things like that, mushrooms we might not appreciate right now. Do you have any ideas of mushrooms you think, you know, this is a really good edible, I think it's pretty safe, I think this is going to be, you know, in the future of restaurants and that kind of thing?
Boy, my attitude's kind of funny. I would like chefs and the public to take more seriously some of the great edibles that are already here. And there are so many wonderful mushrooms that chefs do not cook. They don't know. They have never explored culinarily. And the public, too.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of and defender of one mushroom that people walk by all the time, which is just yellowfeet. They're everywhere. Yellowfeet are everywhere during the winter. And there are these flimsy little drab things that get no respect. And they're absolutely delicious. They're abundant. But trying to get people to eat them and chefs to serve them, people need to get over their issue with textural things where, you know, chanterelles have sort of created a bit of a toothy, chewy quality that people expect. Are button mushrooms, that sort of thing, where you bite into it and it's chewy. There's other mushrooms that are not like this. And yellowfeet is certainly one of them. You know, here we're talking very much to just a California audience, but, you know, one of the great mushrooms, luckily we have them cultivated now in some abundance, but Grifola frondosa, you know, hen of the woods, is one of the world's great mushrooms. They're particularly, since, you know, east of the Mississippi, you guys have them. Out here, we are deprived. We have to deal with cultivated ones. But that's another mushroom that, I mean, it's just a dream come true. It's good for you. It's delicious. It has medicinal properties. You just can't go wrong. But it has a textural thing that the first grower in America to grow them, because they haven't been cultivated for that long. And I started supporting them, and it cost me thousands of dollars to buy their mushrooms, and I would give them away to chefs. And they would be baffled by the fact that you didn't have chewiness with them, because they were like little foul flower petals, you know, so that texture wasn't there. And for people to be more open to the delicious species that we already are just waiting for people to start enjoying. Black trumpets, for heaven's sakes. You know, black trumpets are one of the most delicious, mysterious, grand, fabulous mushrooms. You'd be shocked at how many restaurants do not use them, don't know them. They keep like potatoes. They're just everything, right?
Yeah.
And then you dry them and then rehydrate them. And as a dried mushroom, they're one of the greatest things that you can have in your pantry.
The best.
So
yeah.
We have a lot of things to work with right now that people aren't making use of. And I kind of like to start there with people starting to wake up to the things that are abundant, delicious, and just broaden their horizons a little bit.
I love that. Let's start with the mushrooms that culinarily all, even amateur mushroom pickers, love and adore, and get that into the mainstream before we go with anything, you know, even more obscure.
I mean, you can go on. Matsutake. Matsutake are understood by hardly anybody, you know. They are not commonly served. And this is one of the things that people in Japan walk over hot coals for, you know.
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
right here. They grow all over the place, right here in our world. But they are not taken as seriously as they should be.
Well, it's interesting then to think about the potential of the culinary wild mushroom market. If we can get people's taste buds to adapt to even some of these ones that are well-established, you know, gourmet mushrooms more into the mainstream. And, you know, with that, do you think that commercial mushroom foraging, given those principles of sustainability, things we've talked about habitat, do you see this as something that can expand and keep going into the future? And I'm hoping you say yes, and I want to see more wild mushrooms on every plate. But do you see that as something coming in the coming decades as the realities? Yes, we can expand. We can serve more mushrooms. We can keep it going sustainably.
Well, I do. And in addition to that, you're talking specifically about wild. There's a whole other territory that isn't wild, but is growing wonderfully, which is cultivated exotics. There's plenty of organic growers of cultivated exotic mushrooms. Maitake, you know, Grifola frondosa being one. There is endless room for the growth of consumption of that. And there's more and more species being cultivated that the breakthroughs sadly don't seem to come in this country. They come in Japan, Korea, and China. They've started cultivating Cordyceps militaris, which is, you know, a mushroom that is fantastic. They're cultivating cauliflower mushrooms in China now. There's a lot of mushrooms that can be cultivated in this country that it can add elaborate flavor profiles. We just have to be ready to consume them. The prospect of having the desire grow so much that there's no more mushrooms to be found in the woods, that isn't very likely, but it would drive the price up dramatically. You know, when it's a finite commodity, when it's a finite resource, you know, we unfortunately don't have the ability to go into the woods and create more. It is what we have. We have to protect the habitat of what we have. But certainly people can support the cultivation and consumption of some of the really, really good cultivated, exotic, organically grown mushrooms that are out there. That's one of the reasons for growth, that if people are ready for that, that we just have to get people to start growing them here and be more adventurous. All the growers want to grow oysters and shiitake and enough of that, for heaven's sakes. In Europe, they grow, you know, our equivalent of our bluets. In China and Japan, they grow all sorts of mushrooms.
And I mood even something as simple as wood ear, which is already such a tried and true culinary superstar. We could be growing those. Yeah, it's exciting to see the explosion of smaller gourmet farms. And I think we're going to see a lot of that differentiation where people go with some of these exotics that, hey, everyone's growing oyster and shiitake and even, you know, black pearl, some of these fancy hybrid. I'm going to go with, you know, a wood ear or a sporassus or something like that.
Oh, sporassus are great. Even my fantasy is like I am. You know, my vacations is going mushroom hunting. Right. I will just go to, you know, I was in the Republic of Georgia or Alaska, or I spend a lot of time in Mexico mushroom hunting, because Mexico has a diversity of mushrooms that's greater than our own. It has a culture of mushroom consumption that is ancient, older than most places in Europe. And they're, you know, the indigenous use of wild mushrooms as essentially that was their meat. But I go mushroom hunting when I'm on vacation. But one of my fantasies of something I'd like to do is just get some bales of straw and grow. You know, you go to a Chinese restaurant and they have those little paddy straw mushrooms, the little bitty ones. And they're very difficult to, I mean, their shelf life when they're grown is a nanosecond. But I want to grow those.
Nobody's doing that. And it's, yeah, there's so many ideas like that, that when we talk about the expansion, I'm like, will we ever exhaust the supply of mushroom? There's so much potential for cultivated mushrooms. Like we're not even tapping like a little portion of what's possible when it comes to the amount of gourmet mushrooms we can cultivate and even explore in our wild environments. So I love that optimistic view of the future full of delicious edible fungus. And I would be remiss if we didn't mention the book. And I know the interview is getting a little bit longer, but I'd be remiss if we didn't mention the book. Just talk, you know, a little bit about The Wild Table, what inspired that work, and then what you hoped people took away from reading it. You know, what message you were trying to kind of put forth with that book?
Let's see here. Well, that book was, I wrote that in 2008. So it was a bit before, you know, mushroom craziness. And it was at a time that people weren't as knowledgeable as they are now. But I came up with the structure of it as essentially, I think of it as I had the good be able to pick out some of the ingredients that I really love, organize it by season. I decided that there was an extra season that everybody ignored, which was Indian summer. So I inserted that because that's such a big season for mushrooms to me. And then picked out the various mushrooms and wild foods that I truly love and wrote a love letter to each one of them and wrote my little essay about the things that I think are very profiles of the very character and preciousness of each of those ingredients. And then added recipes that were worked very, 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 very hard over to have recipes that were reflective of the very best of the flavors there. And then include the issues of practical things like shelf stability, shelf life, cleaning, and so on. I was very lucky because that book ended up going up for auction between about 5 publishers, so that a lot of publishers wanted it, which made me feel very flattered. So that was good. And the book's out of print now. So it is, you know, you can find it all probably in used bookstores, Amazon. I have it on our website. I managed to bogart all the leftover copies that the publisher had left. And so I do have those. And that's it. I'm very proud of it. And there's a lot of delicious stuff there.
It's one of my favorites. It was really the first wild mushroom recipe book that I was exposed to when I first started getting into mushrooms and exploring, oh, I can go out in the woods and find food. It really kind of filled that void in, yeah, the early kind of 2010s of being that beautiful kind of heartfelt message with more about the mushroom and then the practical side, the cooking of it. And I know this is going to be really difficult, but if you had to pick, you know, a favorite recipe that you keep coming back to from that book, like I said, I'm sure there's many. What's one that you can share with the audience? Is a recipe that's in there that you just love coming back to over and over again?
Well, I cooked them all, but what I'm going to do today is I have a chef coming over tomorrow and he'll be here in the morning. So, I mean, this is just, it may not be my favorite recipe, but that's what I'm going to do today. It's something that sounds so totally banal. It's chanterelle potato hash. If you haven't tried that, you should, because it's fantastic. But I'm thinking of that because of the hurricane headed for New Orleans. And that recipe is from Donald Link, the great chef in New Orleans, who's a dear friend of mine. And I've taken him mushroom hunting and all of that. And he hunts chanterelles in Louisiana. So Donald came up with something, and it's just fantastic. So you make these little patties, and it goes with everything. It's marvelous. But the other one is, they're not all mushrooms. I'm probably going to make in the East, while you're mushroom hunting, one of the things that you run into, especially in the Southeast, is wild persimmons, which are one of the most delicious things ever. They were the little tiny golf ball sized wild persimmons. And there's a wild persimmon trifle that is so good, but there's plenty of good ones.
That sounds like a perfect lunch right now, is the chanterelle hash and the wild persimmon trifle. And I'm definitely going to try the chanterelle hash. My wife doesn't eat a lot of mushrooms, but when you find that right preparation and mix it with something like, you know, hash potato that she loves, that sounds perfect.
Well, the other one is that when in terms of longevity and value, particularly with the morel season to come, is until COVID, every year I've had a party here, which is a morel stuffing party. And during morel season, I'll end up with all these morels, sort them all per size. Chefs come over. Everybody's required to bring a stuffing, their own stuffing they've concocted. And then there is a great deal of grilling, frying, sautéing, and a lot of wine. And everybody makes stuffed morels with their own stuffing. And we just eat morels all day, stuffed with one thing after another. So that there's recipes for stuffed morels in there, but there's no end of inventiveness about doing that. So all the little accordion pleats of the morels are all crispy and grilled, and it's yummy.
Let the creativity flow, the morel stuffing party. I want that to become a staple for mushroom hunters around the country, is all come together for a morel stuffing party. That sounds incredible. And what are the future plans for you? You know, obviously we're in this time of COVID, and right now as we're recording this, this is in the wildfire season in California. But, you know, what are some of the future plans for you, maybe works or even just personal stuff you're looking forward to?
Well, I'm going to turn, it's not a done deal yet, but because I'm 71 now, I'm nimble and I scamper up trees like a, you know, up hills like a little goat and so on. But probably going to turn my business over to someone that I value very highly and be on the edges. But then what that means is I'll have the freedom to go mushroom hunting in other places wherever I want. And so I will be flitting around Alaska. I'll be able to finally go back to the Queen Charlotte Islands and explore that all over again and spend a lot more time in Mexico in the high country where the diversity of mushrooms takes your breath away. I will be back to mushroom hunting.
I'm sure you'll have no shortage of people that want to play host, to watch Connie scamper around and follow her and pick all the mushrooms.
It'll be fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, where can people find your work? Where can people find, I guess, your mushrooms? Where's the best place to connect with you and Wine Forest?
You know, like everybody else under the sun, we have a website and it's pretty simple. It's wineforest.com. But, you know, you can find all of that stuff there. It's boring to talk about, but there's beauty. I got quite carried away with making some wonderful things that it just sort of got a little out of hand. Everything from strange shrubs made out of wild fruit to never to be ignored as dried mushrooms. Dried mushrooms should play more a part in people's lives, especially COVID is. That certainly taught us a bit about our pantries. And Europe knows this is one of those areas that Americans need to get better at, is using dried mushrooms, hunting them, drying them, using them. They're wonderful.
It's a mainstay of our pantry, largely because we don't eat enough to keep up. So the natural thing you do with your wild finds you can't eat is dry them. And I will say that it's always a treat to be able to pull out last year's morels or last year's porcinis. So yeah, definitely encourage people to go check out the selection of dried mushrooms and everything else. And often this can be too broad a question because it sounds like your path was very much one of following your passion, hacking your way through the bushes to kind of build the life you wanted. But if you had advice for people that wanted to be commercial mushroom foragers or maybe just be part of this ecosystem of wild food purveyors, what is some advice that you could give people listening?
Get rid of your ego. I get very tired of this issue of, unfortunately, it's often a boy thing, that this is not hunting ducks. You know, this isn't doing this sort of thing. This isn't, there's a quietness about this and a reverence for nature that makes this not a competitive sport. That isn't the way you're going to get happy doing this. Mm. And going quietly into the woods and actually being wide open and perceptive is the way you are really going to enjoy this and the way you're going to be successful doing it, whether it is for your own pantry, your own freezer, or whatever it is, or the ability to take them into restaurants and so on. Learn to read habitat. You will never succeed in being a good mushroom hunter or a commercial forager unless you can read habitat. And that goes, I'll give you an example. Black trumpets, as I mentioned before, grow with tan oak trees here in Northern California. They grow with beech trees in the UP of Michigan. They grow here and there. You will have to find that out and learn yourself. But go that extra step and start seeing in the places where you stagger into abundance. Don't just keep your head down. Look up, look around you. See what's around. What is the conjunction of circumstances that created that wonderful patch? And then lock that into your head and look for that intersection elsewhere. An example might be, you know, it's rather well known here that redwoods are not the home of very good mushrooms. I mean, redwoods are not a mushroom-friendly habitat. However, where there's tan oak trees and the stray redwood, the intersection of those two people, those two trees, I called them people. There's an odd redwood in the conjunction with a bunch of tan oaks. That's a little circumstance that black trumpets like, for instance. There's little things like that where you start, observe when you've been lucky. Don't just walk away. Take the time to look around and figure out why.
Absolutely. And I think that advice of being open, observant, perceptive, invaluable. And then, of course, the ego piece. I love how you said that won't be the way you enjoy it. Because I think that's really true. I think that people get too wrapped up in the competition and who's doing better. You're not going to enjoy it as much. Yeah, not only subvert the ego just to be more successful and not alienate everyone around you, but also because you'll enjoy it more. So fantastic, fantastic pieces of advice. And I'll wrap things up with three questions that I like to ask all of my guests, because always the answers are just mind-blowing and fascinating. And the first of which is a mushroom, and I'll just say a mushroom of the moment that we've either talked about or that you love, or maybe it's underappreciated or just might blow our minds, but a mushroom that you love and why.
Okay. I had morels on the brain. Without any doubt, it would be gray morels. Gray morels they're certainly not known in Europe. There's something quite unique to the West. They have not been known that long. They're one of the most delicious things you can ever eat. And they're not common, but you're awfully lucky to find them when you do.
The elusive gray morels, the few times I've gone burn morel hunting, we're always looking, is that a gray morel? Is that a gray morel?
And it's almost always, no, it's not.
It's not. Every time for me, yeah, it's been, no, it's not. Fantastic, elusive mushroom. And then a broader question, and we've probably talked about it in bits and pieces as we've been talking, but what is this relationship that you've developed, this deep relationship with mushrooms and fungi, and even more broadly, this relationship with foraging that you've developed? What has that given to you? You know, what has that brought to your life? This can be lessons it's taught you, perspectives, spiritual understandings, but what has that relationship given to you?
You know, when you're in something so deep, it's sometimes rather hard to step away. It's clearly given me joy. It's made, you know, the fact that we all try to put a roof over our heads, you know, we have our survival strategies. Somebody's a banker, somebody's an insurance salesman. I've been lucky enough to be a professional wild foods person. It's given me joy. It's given me an income. It's given me something that I will never, ever tire of. And I can't, it is all I know. But when I look out the window as I am now, and I'm surrounded by woods, I have a relationship with this that most people do not. And so, I don't know, I think I can see and feel it in its, from 6 feet below the ground until the tip top of the trees. And it's just made my world much, much bigger.
I had a feeling it was going to be kind of an all-encompassing, almost ineffable effect that changes the fabric of who you are and how you perceive reality. And it sounds like that's very much the case. And then a very broad question, but as you know, our culture, and you could broadly say kind of Western quote unquote culture, develops our relationship with fungi and mushrooms, you know, we go through the boom that's happening right now and maybe it continues. How do you see that positively affecting our society in the years to come? Or what are your highest hopes for how we can be positively changed as a culture by our collective relationship with fungi?
Well, I certainly hope that it brings people closer to nature, and that in many ways that it would be an absolute joy if families, and I look at you kids, because children need to get into nature. The possibility of families, not unlike Germans are famous for this, other cultures, families going for hikes and walks in the woods to make this an experience that is, you know, the eternal Easter egg hunt, the thing that children can be so proud of being better than adults in finding treasures. And the fact that this could be a deeply nature enriching experience for humans, for one, that would be glorious and more needed now than ever. And that with that came the desire to protect those places that they get to have possibly some of their happiest times together, and to truly care and be vested in the nature that they get to go to together. Another thing would be something that I take such joy in going to Mexico, and I've been a part of a few programs in Mexico with chefs there, and the ridiculously preposterous idea of me being brought down there to teach Mexican chefs about their own mushrooms. And I've spent a lot of time there 3 years, but it's so Euro, you know, such a class-structured society, and it's the indigenous people that have preserved the knowledge and the love of mushrooms. And, you know, teaching chefs there years ago to look over your shoulder. There's chanterelles everywhere. Look, there's porcinis. You know, use this stuff. But because it's Indian culture, it tended to be looked down on for so long. But that culture is the indigenous use of mushrooms, which is extraordinary in Mexico. And it's many, many, many peoples there. They did not have meat as we do. I'm a carnivore. I'm not ashamed of it. But the fact that mushrooms have functioned as essentially like a version of meat for that for 1,000 years and more, for people to eat more mushrooms, less meat, to consider them a kindred, not a substitute for, something in its very own glory. And more mushrooms, less meat.
More mushrooms, less meat. Well, as a vegan myself, and again, unabashedly so, I do see mushrooms as like the huge piece of the puzzle. When people talk about eating less meat or going plant-based or vegan or whatever you want to call it, the center of that discussion has to be around fungi for me. So yeah, I think that would be a huge benefit. You've, of course, invoked other beautiful concepts like reawakening kind of indigenous threads and connections to mycology that really are the firmament that so much modern knowledge stands upon.
I wanted to tell you one thing. It was kind of a puzzle. One of my heroes was a Mexican mycologist, Gaston Guzman. He's the
legend,
the philosophy man. The late Gaston was a friend of mine. He'd come up here. I'd go down there. He was just one of the most inspiring and fun-loving humans on earth. But he used to do a trick with, he used to do an experiment with indigenous people. And he would have piles, you know, these things, and there would be plant or animal. You would have these two piles, and you were to take all of these things and put it in either plant or animal. The indigenous people there would always take mushrooms, and they would put it into animal. It was almost always that the mushroom was considered an animal, and was because they, their long traditions, they had very few domesticated meat sources, but mushrooms were treated the way we treat meat.
Which, as everybody listening probably knows, mushrooms are more related to animals than plants. So there's that is underlied, borne out by later phylogenies and everything else. Yeah. I hope that vision you're painting is where we're headed. And I like to think that it is. But Connie, thank you so much for coming on, really sharing deeply so many insights, really secrets of the commercial mushroom trade and your own foraging practice, and just so much about yourself and your perspectives on a huge range of topics and giant questions that I'm throwing at you. And you've adroitly caught them and provided us amazing answers. So thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Farewell, dear. Thank you.